أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماؤه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتهدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمم ولا يناله غوص الفطن ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد. اللهم صل على وأهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين صاحب العصر والزمان خليفة الرحمن إمام الإنس والجان ولعن الله وعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. والذين جاهدوا فينا لنهدينهم سبلنا وإن الله لمع المحسنين. صدق الله العلي العظيم. اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد. I know you have your masks on, but let's recite a better salawat than that, please, inshallah, please. Thank you. Cultivating an Islamic identity has been our ongoing topic. Tonight is lecture number 6. For the past 3 nights now, we've been looking at the components of an Islamic identity, starting off with understanding what the I is inside of me, traveling towards the power of thoughts, and yesterday we talked about the fact that the Islamic identity is a mind, body, and soul reality. And my entire purpose last night was this idea that we cannot simply ignore that dimension of the deen that does ask us to live a physically enabled life, meaning that how we dress and what we wear and what we eat and how we live a physical life in this world is all part and parcel of this identity. And we move on from this discussion on the components of the identity, and today and tomorrow, maybe even the next day, we look at the barriers. Theoretically, it sounds great. Right? On paper now, for the past 5 lectures, 6 lectures, it's all kind of been theory. But on the ground, and a lot of my parents can attest to that, who have younger kids now, entering those teenage years now, and trying to kind of inject this Islamic pride inside of them, is a challenge. There's fear, a little bit of anxiety, there's a lot of worry now, and as a father of 3, I'm with you as well. My eldest being 13, my youngest being 6, it's a challenge. And to my young guys who are right now listening to me, late teens, early 20s, mid-20s, there's one thing that I want to mention right off the bat in the beginning, and there might be a lot of you right now who are on the fence, who perhaps maybe don't believe you have all the tools, the courage, to be able to do what I'm asking myself and all of you to do, and that is to really bring home a solid, strong Islamic identity. Let me take you through a little bit of history in the beginning. Inshallah, we'll get to the first barrier on this path. I have an immense affinity towards young people. I'm inspired by them. I find that individuals who are fighting the fight on the ground today to be incredible. Sometimes they'll slip, sometimes they'll fall, sometimes they'll have days and weeks where they're confused. But this dismissal sometimes that we have as a community, as a generation of today's youth, as I mentioned before, Maghrib in Pickering, the idea that, you know, the entire generation is a waste now, these guys are useless, blah, blah, blah. I don't share in that discussion. Because it's my phone that blows up, right? It's the talks I have with a 16-year-old who's trying to understand God. And to the point where, you know, on the other side of the phone now, there's tears. that I want to believe in God, but it just doesn't make sense to me. This portion, that dimension, this discussion. And this fight that they're fighting is that they want to avoid inheriting the religion from mom and dad. They're tired of praying because dad says so. They're tired of coming to the mosque because they're dragged here. It has to come from within, and they want it to come within, but sometimes they're bound by their own principles. This blind faith that they refer to, that doesn't sit well with them. And we know from history that once a young person accepts the truth, that's it. They will work very hard now to preserve that truth. Again, I mentioned this a couple of nights ago. To me, the most powerful stories in the Quran is that of Nabi Musa. His entire story is filled with lessons that apply, I think, to us today. To me, one of the most powerful scenes from the story of Nabi Musa is probably his most famous moment, where he defeats the magicians of Pharaoh. These vetted magicians that he searched Egypt up and down, very confidently now, to bring down Musa, alayhi salam. As you know, didn't happen. Nabi Musa now defeated them in front of all of Egypt. That's not the point that gets me. The point that gets me is that when they were able to see the reality and the truth, nothing mattered at that moment. It's incredible. Here they were, the people of Egypt, that were frightened by Pharaoh, were controlled by Pharaoh. This is a man who not only would control everything about them to the point where he would even dictate to them who to worship. If you want to worship somebody, if you want to see who's worthy of worship, there's nobody better than me, Pharaoh would say. So something as private as worship even, he would hijack, oppress them, rule them using fear. And so any sort of even a glance towards Pharaoh, nobody would do it. And here you have the biggest day of the year in Egypt, the day where everyone comes out, watching this unfold. These seven, I believe, the hadith says, magicians, saw what they saw, and on the spot with Pharaoh sitting on his throne in front of his own people, saying that we now believe in the Rabb of Musa. That's not even the part that gets me. The part that gets me is that Pharaoh becomes livid. He just loses himself. Imagine now the embarrassment. He was convinced, the way he even attended that event, his throne was draped in jewels and diamonds. He himself was draped from head to toe. This was a man who was about to celebrate his biggest defeat of Musa. And it didn't work out like that. He was a favorite. Supposed to sweep Musa in 4 games. It didn't happen. Instead, the underdog won. And his anger now, to the point where the Quran captures this, says, look, I'm going to torture you. And the way that, and I don't mean to be, you know, graphic, but the way that Fir'aun would torture individuals sometimes, cut one limb of one side and the other limb of the other side. Right arm, left leg. Left arm, right leg. Tie him to a tree, the trunk of a tree, let them bleed out. That's cruelty. And when they were threatened with that, it didn't shake them. You do whatever you want to us, they would say. To who? To Fir'aun. But you can't make us unsee what we saw. You can't take the belief away from us. No longer are we ignorant. Are we ghafil? Are we heedless? Now we know. And once we know, we can't unknow. These were young individuals. And I see a dimension of that in today's youth as well. They're not all is lost. Yes, I know there is concern. And there should be, but there's always concern. When I was growing up in this city, 14, 15, there's lots of concern back then. We should never be not concerned. We'll let our guard go down. But when you look at historically, very quickly in the beginning of tonight's lecture, when you look at historically, you look at three major events in Islamic history. One, of course, was the establishment of Islam by the Prophet of Allah in Mecca and Medina. One, of course, was this commemoration, the days of Ashura. And one will be the arrival of our Imam. And the one common denominator in all three of them are the young. The Prophet of Allah would give very difficult responsibilities to young people. And back then, and it still kind of holds true today, back then the culture was, if you were older, a little bit of whiteness in your beard, you were wiser. If you were younger, you were a little bit foolish. And you couldn't be trusted. Right? So the known sort of custom was that if you need something done properly, you have to ask the elders. And sometimes I tell you, in brackets, I don't want to ruffle feathers, sometimes I see that same culture across our culture, our communities. That's why when I see guys like you know, Abbas as a treasurer and Ali Raza as a muki, it warms my heart. Young, good-looking guys, right? Up there on the mic, front and center. Like, Abbas is a good-looking guy, mashallah. Even with a mask on. Ali Raza is fit. I mean, he dresses very well. Zuhair by, alhamdulillah, you... Salu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. It shows that there is this a little bit of trust they have towards the youth. Back then, the Prophet, monumental tasks. The first tabligh mission to Abyssinia, Ja'far, 80 plus people. That's a difficult mission to do. Ja'far in his early 20s. Bilal Habashi, first Mu'addin in Mecca, drive the Arabs crazy. Couldn't say seen or sheen. 18 years old, climbing the Kaaba, giving the Adhan. Amir al-Mu'mineen, up and down all these great wars and these great Zulfiqar stories that we love to hear, warms our heart. All of that, from Badr to Khaybar to Khandaq, all in his 20s. Ghadir, 33 years old. Mus'ab was only 19 years old. Mus'ab was that young man who went to Yathrib and converted the Khazraj and Aus tribes to Muslim, to Islam. Wrote the letter to the Prophet saying, these people are ready for your migration to Medina. The first Salatul Jama'ah in Yathrib before Medina was led by Mus'ab. Mus'ab was only 19 years old. And the Prophet time and time again would say, I'm not concerned about the year that you were born. I'm concerned about the state of your heart. These were young individuals, monumental in establishing Islam and bringing it to its success, like I said yesterday, at a time that was almost unheard of across 23 years. Come to Karbala, the exact same thing. These amazing shahada were all young, and the approach to them was, there was no hesitation, there was no fear. In fact, there was a little bit of rebellious if Imam Hussein ever suggested that you're not going to go and sacrifice your life. And two of them, inshallah, will remember tonight. These are 10 years old, 12 years old, 30, not even baligh yet. And the mission of our Imam will be no different. The point I'm trying to make is that through the lens of the deen, at least, there's something about the jewel of a youth that they see. So what I'm asking all of you to do in this ashra is difficult. It's not easy. But if anybody can do it, it's my young. When you settle, it bothers me. When you convince yourself I can't do it, it bothers me. When you sell all that iman out for the sake of a couple of this and that, it bothers me. That's not who you are. You're above that. You're better than that. You've been raised by these amazing parents in front of me, better than that. And there'll come a moment, if not already, where you'll be asked now to deliver on that tarbiyat. Because my parents all the time now, they'll call me and you know, they'll cry and they'll complain and they'll, you know, kakaringa, what's going to happen? When I asked him, how old is your son? He's 32 years old. I go, he's not a son. He's done. That's it. He's a grown man. You've done your part. Now just do dua. You're a mother, inshallah, it'll be qabool faster. But you've done your part. Now trust that tarbiyat. Because when we go to establish anything that is remotely spiritual, part of that process is to understand the barriers. Those impeding factors that are there flat out to stop us from reaching our spiritual goals. Absolutely. And sometimes it's in our families, sometimes it's in our circle of friends, and sometimes it is the whisperings of shaitan inside of us. And tonight I want to look at one barrier that stops us from developing an Islamic identity. And I'll build on that tomorrow night as well. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, please. This is very in line with the Quran, right? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَلَقَدْ بَعَثْنَا فِي كُلِّ أُمَّةٍ رَسُولًا. For every ummah, every nation, we have sent a prophet. And the prophet had two main messages. أَنِعْبُدُ اللَّهَ وَاجْتَنِبُ الطَّاغُوتِ. Right? Worship Allah, worship Allah, worship Allah, shun shaitan. Shun yani, recognize shaitan. Recognize that barrier. Sometimes I tell you, I think my youth don't understand the power of these deviant forces inside of them and outside of them. And they place themselves in very difficult situations, thinking a little bit of their ego now, that I can escape this moment without being touched by shaitan. I'll go to the club with my friends, but I'll just wait outside the club until they're finished. I'll go to the bar with them, but I'll just order an orange juice. I'll watch these Bollywood movies and I'll forward the songs. Why put yourself in that position? And there are, as many of you know now, there are external forces of guidance and internal forces of guidance. External yani in the form of prophets and imams and parents and ulama and the Quran, all external. Then there are internal forces of guidance, the intellect, the aqal, our logic, tawfiq ilahi, all those are internal. But also there are external modes of disguidance and internal modes of disguidance. Shaitan, not just one, shayateen. Inside we have our nafs, we have our anger, we have our envy, we have our desire. Those, all of them, if not controlled, can really lead us to destruction. So identifying barriers is very key. In fact, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, alayhi salatu wasalam, Allahumma salli ala. It's a very profound hadith. It's beautiful advice. It's one I often share with my community out there in Pickering. I tell the youth this hadith a lot for a reason, because I, you know, it's eye-opening for me. He says, if you are able to do one of two things only, either do good deeds or not commit sin. Either do good deeds or not commit sin. He says, do your best to not commit sin. Because sometimes I tell you, people like me, we approach spirituality like a mathematical equation. I did four good things today. I did two sins today. Four minus two is two. It's positive. Great day. MashaAllah. Shabash. Go to sleep. Plus two. Profit. Oh, it's not that simple. Hold on. Because the base of our spirituality is to identify those barriers, to not commit the sin, to not give into shaitan. And if we spend our whole life just trying to avoid sin, that itself is the greatest of deeds sometimes. So to identify barriers on your path is important. A lot of you ask me, A lot of my young guys in the city ask me, I'm trying, but I can't do this. I set my alarm, I can't get up for Fajr. I want to do this, but I can't bring myself to read, let's say, for example, the Quran. I can't stop myself from music. I can't stop myself from a good old-fashioned gossip session. I can't stop myself from it. I know it's wrong, but I can't. So there's knowledge. It's not a lack of knowledge, but it is a lack of resolve. And what I fear for myself and maybe for all of you is that we take on Shaitan's approach. Remember Shaitan's approach now. Okay? Again, I talked about there are certain conversations in the Quran that I am obsessed with. One of them is God and Shaitan. Up and down the Quran. Multiple moments in the Quran, it captures this moment between Shaitan and God. I believe Surah Al-A'raf from verse 13 to about 18, 19 talks about this one-on-one talk between Shaitan and God. Where God says, why did you do what you did? Okay? When he says famously, أَنَا خَيْرٌ مِّنْهُ, I'm better than he is, and made the entire talk about clay and fire, that's when God says, out. Okay? Now I want you to picture this idea, again, if I can personify the moment a little bit, that they are now, you know, they're having this discussion now. Imagine now, you having a heated talk with somebody, let's say at work in your boardroom with your boss, and he gets to a point where he just says, you know what, you're done, go home, you're fired, whatever, and you begin to storm out of that boardroom. Shaitan is on his way out now. And the Quran captures a moment where it's almost as if he turns back, now metaphorically, turns back now and says something to Allah. فَبِمَا أَغْوَيْتَنِي. This is your fault, God. All of this mess I'm in now is your fault, not mine. I was good before Adam got here. It's all your fault. You knew I wouldn't do this, and still you asked me to do it. I blame you. In the process, he lifted any responsibility off of him and put it on God's shoulders. So when you do that, oh, you think you're good. It's not my fault. He's the one that's being the wrong creator, na'udhu billah. If we don't identify the barriers, we look to people like me look to blame this person and that person and this person and that person. Got to be careful. Hand in hand. Worship Allah, know your barriers. Worship Allah, know Shaitan. Worship Allah, shun Shaitan. Hand in hand together. If you can't do both, just focus on shunning Shaitan. Identify your weaknesses. I have to identify my deficiencies. I've said this before many, many times across a lot of my classes. Shaitan has us figured out sometimes, better than we have ourselves figured out. He's been with us since the moment we came out crying out of mama's womb. He knows exactly. And in the process now, he does a trial and error process. He throws a little bit of a carrot and sees, does this person bite or not? In the process now, he's taking notes. Because everybody now has their own personal shaitan. Everybody has their own personal list of deviances. What pulls me off the path is not what pulls you off the path. What entices you to sin is not what entices me to sin. And while I don't know your list of entices, God does. I'm sorry, shaitan does. And it seems as if he dangles that specific carrot in front of me. If he knows that music is my weakness, everywhere I go, I hear music. And those songs that I'm just attached to. So I'll end up spending a little bit more time in a store, even though I want nothing in that store, because my jam is on. If non-mahram individuals are my weakness, Shaitan knows, he'll dangle that in front of me. If alcohol is not something that I am enticed by, he won't even waste his time. That's all Shaitan, he knows that. But what Shaitan doesn't have that we have is God. Ya ilahi, la takilni illa nafsi tarfata aynin abada. The Prophet of Allah. Oh my Lord, ya ilahi, do not leave me alone or at the disposal of myself for a blink of an eye, the Prophet says. I can't do this without you. And when we look at this idea of Islamic identity, One of the biggest barriers is today's Islamophobia. Now, I'm not talking about the actual ones who are carrying out these attacks. The actual Islamophobes, I'm talking about a different angle and dimension of it. That, of course, is there. And unfortunately, it's going to be there. Those London attacks may not be the last one we see, unfortunately. In a post-9/11 world, it's just a reality. It's a matter of how we navigate through that phobia. But I'm not talking about an external Islamophobia. I'm talking about an internalized Islamophobia. What do I mean by that? Let's explain. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, please. And I'll use sometimes, you know, this idea of internalized racism. We're watching, you know, this anti-racism movement in the U.S. between the African-American community and the Caucasian community. And there's whole studies done on the idea that there are some individuals that belong to the minor race, the inferior race, the oppressed race. And after a while, when you face that oppression enough times, you begin to actually believe that, yes, they are the superior race. They are the superior color. We are the inferior color. We'll never be them. And you take the external racism and you subconsciously now you begin to internalize it. You actually convince yourself that, yes, I'm African American, I'm a second class citizen. Subconsciously. And this inferiority complex kicks in. Now that has an immense impact on your identity, to the point where sometimes there are people who actually physically try to change their appearance. They'll bleach their skin. They'll straighten their hair. They'll change the way they talk. They'll get nose jobs to shrink their nose. I don't want any physical resemblance of the inferior race. I want to try to look like them so they can accept me. That's a huge issue right now. Now that's internalized racism. Bring the exact same principle to internalized Islamophobia. There are some of us who have the exact same subconscious feelings inside of us. That when we look around the world right now, I talked about Afghanistan right now, and Yemen, and Palestine, and you see almost as if every Islamic nation, every Islamic group is under attack. How could it be that everybody is wrong and we're right? Why are we always the target? Now you come here, for example, a random family going for a walk in London, Ontario, and a tragic event happens. My Muhajjaba sisters, my warriors on the path, they have 1,000 stories of being ridiculed, tugged on, asked all sorts of weird questions, made fun of. After a while, it starts to seep in and you start to think, maybe they're right. Maybe we're wrong. And so the script flips. No longer is it the idea that I'm trying to export Islam, I'm trying to now remove Islam from me. So I'll do exactly what the race does. I'll start to not look the part. The hijab comes off, the beard comes down, I start to now develop the culture of the, you know, superior religion or superior lifestyle, which includes alcohol, which includes all sorts of stuff online, which includes adultery, which includes changing my name, which includes everything, even to the point where I won't wear anything resembling a Muslim outfit. Even my fashion sense will change. All because subconsciously now I believe that I am the inferior religion. There was a study done. Those of you who know Noor Kids, Amin Asir, his wife did an amazing study on this very issue of internalized Islamophobia. Now, I've been using the word subconscious over and over again because many might think, yeah, right, who thinks like that? You'd be surprised. Even my hijabi sisters, when they're getting ready, they have all sorts of discussions. Is this an okay outfit? Am I kind of, you know, am I able to maintain some form of fashion and then still follow the rules of God? Oh, may God bless them. It's not easy. Those are my sisters who are on the fence about hijab. Sometimes I think you guys think that those who wear hijab since you're 9 have it easy. No, every day it's a struggle. Every day it's a struggle. They might make it look easy, but it's not easy at all. Trying to balance somehow looking fashionable and still being covered is not easy. That's why a lot of the time the lines are blurred. And the study that she did is eye-opening. In America, and these are 5 to 9-year-olds, kids, about this very issue of Islam. Now, she used dolls and, you know, the whole experience she did, but the results are astonishing. I read 3 sets of results. She writes that 1 in 2 kids, age 5 to 9, did not want to tell their classmates they were Muslim. 1 in 3 kids did not realize they could be American and Muslim at the exact same time. Now, when you don't understand the idea, that's why my very first discussion, which feels like years ago now, right? My very first discussion was about the prophets instilling the deen into a pre-existing culture. That was a very crucial foundational discussion. To say, look, it's okay, and I'm sorry, my parents, don't be upset. It's okay to say I'm a Canadian Muslim. It's okay to say I'm a Muslim. It's okay to see the Canadian flag inside the symbol of our Islamic institutions. We haven't sold anything out. But it's astonishing. These kids didn't know. Can I call myself American Muslim? And 1 in 6 kids, she says, pretended they weren't Muslim. It's astonishing to me. To young kids. That's why it is vital in passing, I say, don't underestimate the power of having an Islamic identity in the home. And start them very, very young. These are clean slates in your home. Sometimes I wonder at some of parents, and again, I also struggle with this, that there's no Islam in the home, there's no Islam outside of the home, and then there's complaints that bachcha jo hai na namaz padta hai na wo, where will he get these values from? It's not inside his 4 walls, it's not inside society, it's not online, it's not inside of him. What's the shock? Why are you shocked? Did you give him the tools? Did you sacrifice and compromise? Or was it a little bit of a pinch of this and a pinch of that? And, you know, a very gray religion, blurred lines, confusion, to the point where, forget it. And that starts from a very, very young age. You can't all of a sudden expect your daughter at 9 to wake up and want to wear hijab if the right work hasn't been done for the previous years. The study I'm talking about is from age 5 to 9. Imagine now a 17-year-old. How many times do we correct someone's pronunciation of my name? How many times do I engage in a debate about Islamic politics today? How many times do I sit there and do my best to answer properly when they ask me as a muhajjaba, why do you wear a hijab on your head? Because my mom says so. Because I have to. How many of us run from those situations? So the first barrier is an internalized Islamophobia inside of us, which plays with everything from our pride to our worship to our sense of community to everything. Anything that has a resemblance of Islam, we run from. Be it our own look, be it the 4 walls of a masjid, be it certain days of the year, that's it. inside of the discussion on racism, when you look at, for example, the idea of internalized racism inside the African-American community, there's even a further discussion on the shade of black that you are. And the darker your skin is, the more racist or more racism you'll feel. The lighter skinned ones don't face as much. So now to the point now where this internalized racism is based on a color scale, a palette almost. That if my skin is dark, I have to now increase that racism. If I'm a little bit lighter, same idea. Where there it's color, here it's spirituality. So I'll just do enough to say, okay, you know what? I'm not that bad. I'll just keep my beard a little bit light. I'll just move my hijab 1 inch above. That way I'm still covered, but I have my bangs to show it. I'll move my pants just a little bit up to show my ankles and have a nice little jewelry around my ankle. Just enough to say, look, you know what? I'm not crazy. I'm good. Right? Levels of piety. Or I'll convince myself, or I'll blame others that, look, you know what? Like Shaitan did, فَبِمَا أَغْوَيْتَنِي. I'll sit there and say, you know what? I do this, for example, because everyone else does it. You know how many times, and this is very unfortunate, I'm sorry for bringing it up on a member, when I talk to couples, and I'm in no way am I a counselor. I'm not even close to it. I lend an ear, that's all I do. Sometimes when I talk to couples, what's becoming more and more common and just accepted is adultery. Just accepted. In terms of sense, well, you know, like, what is it that he's doing? Is he with other women? Yeah, that's he's been doing for years. Whatever, I've accepted that. But he does this. Wait a second. What about this? How can that be accepted? Everyday common. Everyone's doing it. Right? You reach a point now where you get midlife crisis and you kind of, you know, one woman smiles at you the wrong way at work and that's it. That's all it takes for a man sometimes, right? How many times, you know, have I heard that my dad has a whiskey bar in the basement? Apne Shia log. No, Malana. Yeah. And they say, look, I don't bring it to the house. I don't get drunk. When I have a long day, I have one glass and that's it, right? That's the levels of spirituality. You kind of, you know, blur those lines. It's all internalized Islamophobia, all of it, internalized. I'm tired of blaming this ism and that ism and this ism. Let's begin to look inwards. That's what I'm tired of. It's their fault. Yes, they will do what they do best. They will pour in money and they will have all sorts of now, you know, different groups and different active groups that are there to dismantle this sense of spirituality. Fine. They will do what they want to do. Why are you succumbing to all this? And the Quran now, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, some of these verses are very, very firm. And I love God's firmness. Sometimes he shows a side of him and I'm like, yes, that's my creator. Oh, I love it. The confidence, the strength, the might. Like, he presents himself as untouchable sometimes. I want to jump on that bandwagon. I want that confidence. Right? He talks about the idea. For example, just one example. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, please. He talks about the creation of the seven heavens. And then he says, Ma tara fi khalqi Rahman min tafawut. Surah Mulk. The seven heavens were created in layers, tabaqa. Verse number 3 of Surah Mulk, in layers. Then he says, you will not see, ma tara, you will not see in the creation of the beneficent Lord any sort of tafawut, no discordance, no discrepancies, nothing. If that's not enough, again, he says, go back and look. Hal tara min futur, do you see any discordance? Now, the example I gave at Al-Mahdi was that you ask your child to clean your room, right? Clean your room. Clean your room. And you decide as a child, oh, watch how I clean my room. Sometimes when kids get in the mood for cleaning, oh, they do a very good job. So now an hour, 2 hours have passed, the door is closed, this person's cleaning their room. So confident that they actually summon you. Mom, Dad, Ammi, Abbu, come here. Check out my room. You pop in, oh, okay, that's good, it's clean. Very nice. No. Come here. Open the closet. Open the drawers. Look how I did my socks. Check under the bed. Look behind the curtain. Look at my notes. Look at my desk. I even Lysol wiped the desk. I wiped down the mirror. And your kid is standing there almost challenging you. Find me a speck of dust. Put on your white gloves. Touch everything. That confidence, God says, look in the universe. Look over and over and over again. Tell me one instance of discordance. Tell me where there is discrepancy. To the point where he says that you will keep looking, to the point where your basar, your eyesight will come back, khasi'an wa huwa hasir, confused and exhausted. Your eyes will get tired, but you won't find a single discrepancy in my system. Oh, what a God. That's confident. That's the kind of God I want. I don't want a weak, No, I want a firm God. A firm God I want. A strong God. Nothing can, you are, if you stand beside me and behind me, nothing will touch you. That same God in the Quran says, the ones who say that their Rabb is Allah. It's one of my favorite verses. قَالُوا رَبَّنَ اللَّهِ ثُمَّ اسْتَقَامُوا. This is a very important verse. These are not just people who say La ilaha illallah, thumma istaqamu. They resist. They fight. They don't bend. They don't apologize. They don't lie down. Say, oh, the West got me. The Islamophobes got me. What am I supposed to do? I'm bound by fashion. What can I do now? I won't get a job if this or that. What do I do? Everyone's doing it, so I can do it too. I just want to be accepted. That's not thum mustaqamu. If you can say that my Rabb is Allah and you don't move from where you are, you become a mountain like Imam Ali says. A mu'min is like a jabal, like a mountain. The wind can howl all it wants, the mountain won't move. When that happens, tatanazzalu alayhim wal malaika. Angels come down with three pieces of news. Allah takhafu, wa la tahzanu, wa abshiru bi jannati allati kuntum tu'adun. Look at the first two. Don't grieve, don't fear. You have nothing to worry about. Don't be upset, don't be sad, and don't be fearful. Why? You have God on your side. You've shown God. God, I'm not just lip service. I'm not just la ilaha illallah. No, I say that. قَالُوا رَبَّنَ اللَّهَ, and then also I stand firm in where I am. I don't allow anyone to come in and hijack my belief. There are some people who, you know, the result of a London, Ontario attack is what? That they actually become stronger in their faith. There are those now who fall down. If you want to, if I want to cultivate an Islamic identity, ask yourself, I'll ask myself tonight a very tough question. Is there internalized Islamophobia inside of me? Do I really believe that Islam is the path? Am I really proud to be a Muslim? If someone says Assad, do I go, oh, no. Someone says Muhammad, do I stop and Fatima, Hassan? Do I stop and say, no, because your name is your identity. If someone sits there and talks about, let's say, for example, Yemen, do you hide? No. Are you proud? On the day of Eid, you can ask him, can I go home? It's my Eid. These are things that we need to implement inside of our homes, inside of our kids, inside of ourselves. And God says, if you do that, leave the fearing and the grieving to me. I'll remove all those elements. Don't need to fear anybody. You have God on your side. And if you get nothing from this Azadari and Imam Hussein, know that that man entered the plains of Karbala fearless. 30,000 people approaching you. To not talk, they wanted to destroy the man. And all he kept saying, if my Nana's deen needs to be protected, I need to be killed, bring on the swords. And his father did the exact same thing on the night of migration. There was this whole attempt of assassination of the Holy Prophet. One member from that tribe, one member from that tribe, when he sleeps in his bed, kill the man in his bed. The Prophet says, Ali, this is their plan. Can you sleep in my bed? And the one question the father of Hussein asked was, by me sleeping here, will your prophethood be saved? Didn't say, oh, wait, what do you mean? Who? Are you sure? Me? What if they kill? No. Same question his son asked on Plains of Karbala. If by me sleeping here, you're saved, I'll sleep. He did. If by me being killed by arrows on the Plains of Karbala, this deen is saved, then so be it. There's no fear there. There's thumma istaqamu there. There's resistance there. I'm not going to sway from where I am. I need that from all of you. I need that from myself. This deen needs its warriors. And I know my youth right now listening to me, either here, online, all of you have the skill set to do it. I've seen you conquer huge obstacles in your life. I've seen young people, youth, fight through their mental health issues. I've seen people fight for their marriages. I've seen people raise amazing children. I've seen them pick up their life and go to a different country for their kids and make it work. I've seen them tackle their body issues, their mental health issues, some sort of an issue with a family member. I've seen you conquer it all. Conquer this phobia inside of you. It's my challenge to all of you who embrace my challenge. I'm with you. I'll challenge myself as well. As I oftentimes say, learn the deen from the deen. Don't allow those who have no business telling you about spirituality and ethics and morals and values dictate to you about your morals and values and ethics. The biggest barrier we have, I think, in my opinion, of identity is the fact that I think deep down inside of us, some of us, we have this inferiority complex that comes from internalized Islamophobia. We gotta fight it, recognize it, face it. Don't be afraid to look deep down inside. And then fix it. Like I said before, once we know there's a knife in our back, we look to go, remove that knife, stitch up the wound, and then do our best now to make sure that wound doesn't get affected. Correct? Yeah. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. And like I said before, that study I presented between 5 and 9 years old, and the segue is beautiful into Masaib. It starts from the lap of the mother. The first madrasa of any human being is the lap of the mother. You know, one year I'm going to recite a whole ashra on mothers. I tell you, there's not enough you can say about mothers. Until you lose your own mother, you don't realize the power of it. Doesn't matter how old she becomes or how sick she becomes, it doesn't matter. That shade, that saya, that safety, when it leaves this world, you really feel it. As Imam Sajjad says, that mother that would go hungry so you could eat, thirsty so you could drink, stand in the burning sun so you could lay in the cool shade, carry you when no one carries you, and do it over and over and over again. Even right now, there are some sisters right now on that side of the hall in the gym on that side who packed up their newborn, sitting beside their car seat, brought all the coloring books and all of the snacks, absolutely. Made sure they had their masks, everything. Knowing full well they might fall asleep. Carry them inside, unpack the snacks, tuck them in. Make sure that transition from your lap to the bed is perfect. That's a huge transition. And do it again tomorrow night. And that's why, to me, some of the unsung heroes of Karbala are the mothers of Karbala, who would stand there at the entrance of the khaymah and tent, look out in the Maidan of Karbala and witness the killing of their son. It's not easy. And we, as men, we can never understand the sacrifice of the likes of Rabab and tonight of Bibi Zainab. If the innate nature of a mother is to protect the child, the innate nature of the mothers of Karbala was to ensure that Hussein's mission is met. Where mothers usually protect their kids from hurt, these are those mothers that would prepare their kids for battle. Ona Muhammad were not even baligh yet. They had no business being out there on the battlefield. This war is not for kids that age and that size. When they approached Imam Hussein for ijazat and permission for war, Imam Hussein looked at them. These were his nephews. He was their mamu. Anybody here in this room who has a sister, who has kids, you know that those kids are a little bit different from everybody else. I don't know how Imam Hussein could look at these two precious faces and somehow say, yes, I give you ijazat. I give you permission. But that's what he did. He gave permission. Ali Akbar comes forward, Abu Fazl comes forward, and they prepare Ona Muhammad for battle. They couldn't find armor to fit these bodies. They couldn't find helmets to fit these bodies. They couldn't find the shoes to fit these bodies. One report said that after 6 or 7 helmets that wouldn't fit the head of Ona Muhammad, Hussein grabbed a green cloth and tied the imamah on each of their heads so their helmet could fit. At that moment now, Ali Akbar now mounts one on the horse, Abbas mounts the other, and they watch as these two now roar inside the Maidan of Karbala, announcing that we are the sons of Ja'far. The blood of Bani Hashim runs through our vein. And so long as they were together, they were unstoppable. They would kill 13, 15, 21 grown men with their swords alone. Several men on the horse, but Umar ibn Sa'd realized, if this continues, I can't beat them. These are the sons from Ali's Khandan. So they separated these two boys. On went one way, Muhammad went the other, and as true to their fashion, they would now surround each boy, ambush them, and there came a moment now where they fall from the horse. Assalamu alayka, ya Aba Abdullah. Hussein goes roaring inside the Maidan of Karbala, brings On back. Abbas goes roaring inside, brings Muhammad back. For every other shaheed, my brothers and my sisters, there was one common custom. When Hussein brought a shaheed back, Zainab would be waiting for him. Zainab would be the first person he met. She would give the sali to Zainab, to Hussein. She would give support to Hussein. Hey, bhaiya, don't worry. I'm with you. Hey, bhaiya, don't worry. Allah is with you. I'm right beside you. I'll support you. She would cry with the shaheed. She would go to the mother or the brother or the father of the shaheed and send her condolences. But now that Ono Muhammad has come back to the Khaymah, everybody is there, but Zainab is not there. Hussein says, where is Zainab? I don't see Zainab. Zainab is inside the Khaymah, in sajda. Ya Allah, accept my Khalil sacrifice. Hussein then lies down Ono on the ground, lies down Muhammad on the ground, separates the two, and he himself goes inside the tent and slowly but surely bring Zainab in front of her two boys. My Shahzadi Zainab kneels down, places one hand on the chest of Own, one hand on the chest of Muhammad, and again repeats, Ya Allah, accept this Zainab's Khalil sacrifice. Fatima Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein.